Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters Radio.
Well, good morning. Here we are for another session of Growth Matters on the first Friday in 2014. And I'm excited this morning because my guest is Scott Geller. And currently, he's the Chief Technology Officer of Points of Light. And for those of you that may not be familiar with Points of Light, they are a nonprofit organization that collaborates with corporations, foundations, government agencies, and community-based nonprofit organizations to measure impact and identify effective ways and practices for volunteerism. And so Scott will share a little bit about what's happening at Points of Light. But also, Scott has started multiple businesses, and we're going to pick his brain a little bit today about some of the things he's learned from that process. So welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Michelle. Glad to be here.
Good. So did you have a nice time off sort of at the end of the year with holidays?
I did. Our offices are actually closed between Christmas and New Year, so it was very relaxing.
Well, nice. Well, I'm glad that you were able to come and join us this morning. So, Scott, why don't you, even before we start talking about the various ventures and companies you've started, tell us just a little bit about your background. Where did you go to school? Where you're originally from? Just sort of the nickel tour of Scott.
So I grew up in Akron, Ohio.
Soapbox Derby country.
Soapbox Derby, World Series of Golf. It's a great place to grow up.
Great.
It's a great place to be from. My family was in the car business, so we sold Mercedes and Toyotas in the 70s and 80s, and our business was right across the street from Goodyear's international headquarters. And when we started off, it was very verboten. I guess that's a funny word to use, to sell German and Japanese cars in a Midwestern industrial city. And 10 years later, all the executives from all the rubber companies, who mostly had been bought themselves by Japanese companies, would buy Mercedes and Toyotas and change the tires. So, you know, just another symbol of how things change. And, you know, as I was growing up, they closed the factories. One day, the headline in the Akron Beacon Journal was 20,000 people laid off because all the jobs were moving south.
Wow.
So, you know, when I grew up, the South was the place where jobs went. Now it's, you know, to China and India, but in those days it was to Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama from Ohio. So very interesting times for us.
Yeah. So where'd you go to school?
I went to University of Pennsylvania. I went to public high school in Akron, went to University of Pennsylvania undergrad, and did an economics degree there, and decided I wanted to get into computers and software. And I actually switched disciplines into computer science to get a master's in computer science at UC San Diego. So went from Philadelphia to San Diego, lived on the beach for a couple years. My first job was actually back in Cleveland, which I swore I would never do, but I somehow ended up back in Cleveland. I had a great opportunity with a guy that I played in a college band with. To work at the national headquarters of Ernst & Winnie at the time, before it became Ernst & Young, and got our hands on some of the first IBM PCs and developed training classes for Lotus 1-2-3, if you even remember what that is.
I do. I worked for IBM there for a while.
That's right. You did. That's how I started my career. And Ernst, the deal was when you worked at the national headquarters, you worked there for 2 to 3 years, and then they let you pick any city on the map you could move to. And I had 5 different cities to choose from, and I picked Atlanta. So they put all my stuff on a truck, my car, all my earthly belongings, and moved to Atlanta in about 1987.
Okay, and been here ever since. Have you ever left Atlanta?
I have not left.
Okay.
I'm officially a native now, I think, after 25 years.
Yeah. So sounds like in your background of your family, you had sort of this entrepreneurial owning your own business. Did you always think that this would be something that you wanted to focus on, or kind of how does the childhood part of this play in?
So I do think when you grow up, seeing your grandfather start a business and then your father take it over. My other grandfather owned a drugstore, so I think it was in my blood. And I actually remember going to my first day at Ernst & Winnie thinking, wow, this is really weird working for somebody else. I'm sure I'll enjoy it, and I did. But I pretty much knew at some point I would be doing my own thing.
And why is that? Like, what is it about being an entrepreneur that sort of gets you up in the morning?
It's kind of hard to describe, but I think it's a feeling of no limit, that the only limits you have are limits you put on yourself, whereas if you work for somebody else, you have artificial limits and constraints that are there from day one. So, and I think there's just a sense of creation, of being able to create something that didn't exist or might not have ever existed had you not done it. So, you know, there's a lot of different reasons and ways to become an entrepreneur, but for me, I think that was it.
Yeah. So, as I teed up at the beginning of our show, you have had the opportunity to do a number of different startup and being on the ground floor of businesses, both in the for-profit and nonprofit world. So before we kind of dig a little bit deeper into each of those, just sort of generally, what's the big difference between starting up something that's for-profit versus nonprofit, other than the obvious word profit? What are some of the big differences and what are some of the similarities that you've seen?
So some of the similarities, you're providing a product or a service to, either a constituency or a customer base. So in that sense, you're trying to create value for somebody. You're trying to solve a problem, whether that problem is ending hunger, ending a disease, or helping a pharmaceutical company be more efficient in their manufacturing. You know, one way or the other, you're trying to create a valuable product or service. Not every for-profit has a board, but pretty much every nonprofit does. So if you're the CEO or founder, you should be accountable to a board and have to, set goals and objectives and strive to meet or exceed those goals. So I think that's another thing that's similar. Definitely one bottom line is that managing cash and growth are really important, no matter whether you're a nonprofit or for-profit. I found, starting TechBridge, which was a nonprofit, my experience of running a for-profit that was not, it was all built by internal cash, watching every dollar. In nonprofit, you can get away with having things donated, but you can actually, in a startup, you can get things donated in a way. You can give away options or equity in exchange for things instead of cash. You can get people excited about your idea and get them to do things because they share your vision. But being frugal, I think, in a startup of any kind is super important. And then the other thing is finding a way to have recurring revenue is really important. In nonprofit, they use the term sustainability. And funders love organizations that find, first of all, a value-added source of revenue, not always relying on donors, and especially if there's some kind of recurring nature to it. Mm. So and I've had for-profits that had to start off beginning of January, you have to start off the year at zero. That's a very tough place to be at. But Points of Light is starting off the year with a significant amount of recurring revenue because we sell software as a service. So that's another thing. It's apropos for the beginning of the year to be thinking about how can you have recurring revenue so you don't have to start the year at zero.
Yeah. So just talk to us a little bit for our listeners that maybe 2014 is the year that they have an idea and they want to start their own business. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your first business? As I understand, that's Business Systems Design.
Mm-hmm.
BSD is the acronym that you use, and it's still in existence today. Talk to us a little bit about sort of the impetus to start that particular company, and then maybe one or two things that are really key to help it being successful and growing.
So that one did have a bit of a running start because I was working for someone else on 100% commission. So that had all the disadvantages of business ownership and very few of the advantages. The owner of the company had said he would give me equity in the company, and I sold a miracle deal. He was about to go out of business. I sold a big deal, generated enough profit that kept the doors open. He was able to stay in business like another 10 years. And then we had our chat at the end of the year in my performance review, and he said, well, if you stick around for another year, I might give you 2% of the company. And so about 2 months later, I said, I've got a better idea. How about if I leave and start my own company and, you know, let's work something out. So we actually did an agreement. I paid him a little bit of money to have the right to take my customers with me. He was so convinced I would be out of business and begging him back for my job that he was willing to give me a pretty sweetheart deal. So I actually had a partner, one of the other sales. There were three of us, actually. One of them dropped out right away. He went back to work for this guy because he couldn't afford to go even a couple months without cash. The other guy lasted 6 months, and I ended up buying him out because I was out working, earning all the money with our existing clients, and I called back to the office to see how his sales efforts were going, and he was at a golf tournament. And I asked him, well, what are you doing at a golf tournament? He said, well, the reason I started, you know, I wanted to go into business for myself was so I could do things like this. I said, well, maybe you should, you know, do things like that after you generate some revenue. So, you know, we parted company at that point. So then it was my own business within 6 months and grew it steadily. That was it was a service business, and we were selling customization of a software package for manufacturers. So we sold the package. We also customized it. And so, you know, we grew it to – it wasn't a huge business. It had like 15 people, $2 million in revenue.
So what was the hardest thing about that business and starting it and having it be successful?
Well, so we had a relationship with a big company. So we were our own entity, but we were a reseller. And the software company that we worked with went public, and they started having needs for their own, of their own. So they started trying to push us into smaller and smaller deals and take more and more of the service revenue for themselves. What we were able to do is build an add-on product that they needed, and they ended up selling it through their sales force. So we actually generated $1 million in incremental revenue from that and became a stronger partner for them. But that was a challenging time. There were several of my peers around the country that were going out of business because this company was kind of encroaching on what had been their territory.
Yeah, so what was sort of a lesson learned for you from that experience that maybe has served you well as you've continued to be an entrepreneur?
So, I mean, you always have to, whatever business you're going into, you have certain reliances on other outside forces or companies. And, I mean, there are degrees of risk and independence that you can have. If you have your own product that's built on open source, for example, open source are free, not owned by anyone products, that's probably the ultimate in freedom. You don't have reliance on any outside organizations, especially in the software business. If you're a reseller of any kind or you're a franchisee, you know, that's a very different relationship, and you have to go into that with your eyes open that the rules can change, that, you know, depending on who the CEO is or whether they had a bad quarter, their strategy can change, and that can impact you, you know, one way or the other. You know, I guess you learn over time that the level of risk comes with certain compromises. Obviously, if you start your own thing with your own product, you don't have anyone else to draft off of. It's more risky. But if you're successful, then you have less reliance.
Yeah. So then talk to us about what was your next entrepreneurial venture after BSD?
So again, that it was an evolution from BSD. So we created our own product that was an add-on to their product. And again, what happened was they fired the CEO who had a great relationship with. We had a written contract that they had to pay us a royalty. The new CEO happened to come from a company that competed with what our add-on product did. There were only five companies in the world that had this, but he happened to come from one of those five. And, of course, he wanted to switch them as quickly as possible to his old company's product. So they came in and said, I know we have a written contract, but we're just not going to live up to it. And, if you know, you're a little company. If you want to sue us, go ahead. But we'll put you out of business on a cat. We just won't pay you, and you'll go out of business by the time you can sue us and get the money. So either you take half the royalty or something like that as a third less royalty than what we've agreed to in writing, or we'll just play hardball. So that was another lesson.
I guess.
So the first lesson was, you know, they told me to trust me. We don't need to put all this in writing. I had a great relationship with the CEO, but, you know, when he was fired, his whole team was fired. There was nobody left. All there was what was on the piece of paper. And then I learned that what's on the piece of paper is only as good as my ability to sue or defend myself against a lawsuit. So what did we do? We decided to take that product and build our own company around that product. So it was a quotation and configuration product. So if you sold, they were selling to custom make-to-order manufacturers. So if you were making a pump and your pump had 100 different options and they each affect the price. And if you got option A, then it affected which option B you could choose. So like if you were buying a car, the exterior color, only certain interiors would come with that exterior color. If you change the exterior color, then the interior colors change. So it managed all those kind of relationships. And at the time, this was in 1996, people wanted to be able to sell on laptops. You know, this was, if you think back before mobile phones and iPads.
Way back in the dark ages of technology.
Yeah, so the big thing was instead of having to go back to the office to take the order, so, I mean, you work for IBM. If you want to sell an IBM, I mean, now everything is configured to order in computers, and they were one of the first to do it. So instead of having to go back to the office, you could take a laptop with you to the customer, take the order, give them the price, show them what it would look like in some cases, and actually close the deal in their office. So that was a pretty powerful concept. And one of our to make a long story a little bit short, we ended up raising capital. I had to sell the service business off to the employees because the employees who were generating the profits that was paying for this development of this new product felt like they owned a new product. So that was another lesson, which is that when you have especially a small company with under 20 employees, I did a very good job of creating ownership. A sense of joint ownership. But at some point, joint ownership only goes so far. So, and the other thing is that not everybody shared my vision. So there, you know, I was going to the promised land and they were in the desert as far as I was concerned, but to them, it was the promised land where they were. So, it worked out great because I had an employee that that actually a couple years earlier had stolen one of my biggest clients and got into a big fight with them. And he came back and said, I want to buy the company from you, and came up with some cash. And he bought the company, and it's still around 15 years later. So that gave me some startup capital. I raised friends and family round at that point and finished the product, got our first few customers for the laptop product. Then went out to raise venture capital for that. So it was another evolutionary step, Nada.
So before we talk about TechBridge, which was one of your nonprofit ventures, talk to us a little bit about sort of positioning yourself to be attractive to venture capitalists. How, you know, are there a couple of tips that you can give our listeners today that if that's a road that they're going to go down, how they can sort of make the most of that opportunity or potential opportunity.
So this should make all your listeners feel better. I got turned down 38 times.
Wow.
For venture capital. Every single local investor turned me down. Some of them turned me down two or three times for different reasons. That enough time went by that I could ask them again, and they said no again.
So persistence is a strong suit of yours.
Yes. I sold door-to-door one summer in college, and if you learn nothing else from that, you learn how to take no for an answer and go to the next door.
Yeah.
So persistence for sure. And the game has changed quite a bit. I mean, it depends a lot where you are. If you're raising venture capital in Atlanta or on the West Coast, or somewhere smaller than Atlanta, you know, being in the right place, asking for money for the right kind of business is the first thing. It's very difficult today to raise money for certain types of businesses. Although Atlanta's changed quite a bit in those days, business to consumer was very difficult to raise money for. And it's still in the software business, at least. If you're trying to raise money, it's a lot easier to raise it in Atlanta if you're doing a business-to-business mm-hmm. kind of business model than a Twitter or a Facebook or something like that, where you're not going to see revenue for years and years while you're building your user base. So being smart about what kind of business you start where to raise money for, or going out of town and raising it, you know, there are folks that have moved to Silicon Valley because they had the kind of business that really requires Silicon Valley investors. So I'd say that's the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, other than in 1998 and 99, when anybody could raise money for anything, generally speaking, having some experience doing what you're doing, having really before you raise venture capital, it's very difficult to just do it on a napkin and with an idea. Even in this market, and especially in Atlanta, it's best to find a way to build a product with very little cash. If you're not a developer, I'm talking in the software context, mm-hmm. of course, but if you're not a developer, have a friend that is, that shares your vision, that you can split the equity, somehow get a product, you know, either near to market or to market, and show some kind of traction before you go ask for money. In our case, I mean, we actually had the experience of having we had hundreds of customers with our previous product, and we had a new product we'd already built with friends and family, and we had our first two beta customers of that. So
you had a story that you could basically tell them. Yeah. So let's shift a little bit. One, so TechBridge, for those that are not familiar with TechBridge, it is a nonprofit here in Atlanta, a very successful nonprofit that focuses on technology support for the nonprofit community. So talk to us a little bit about what made you want to start TechBridge and kind of a couple of lessons learned from that experience.
So the company that we were talking about that was venture-backed ended up being sold to a public company in January of 2000, which is a whole story in itself. But I went through the whole dot-com era where it was just in a period of extreme excitement but extreme greed and selfishness. So I was part of that, I'll admit it. It didn't end quite as well as I had hoped, but still well enough that I could afford to take some time and do something to give back. And so literally 2 weeks after we closed that deal, the first week of February of 2000, a friend of mine, Steve Lenos and Jennifer Mendel, two friends of mine, came up with this idea of and had actually already written a business plan for a nonprofit that would donate pro bono consulting and then charge to kind of be a broker in between the volunteer and the company that was volunteering in the organization. And they were looking for funders, really, just to donate money. And I wasn't thinking I was going to get involved with my time at that point. There was also another separate initiative called the Digital Ball, which Jennifer had been involved with another group. Tom Verton from Silicon Valley Bank was wanting to bring the Silicon Valley Charity Ball concept to Atlanta. Atlanta was, you know, emerging as a tech community in its own right. And so there was an idea being tossed around of merging these two organizations together prior to their really even getting off the ground. So it was really exciting because there was the opportunity to both engage the technology community and all the VCs and the startups. At that time, that's who we were focusing TechBridge on, because that's all anybody thought about in January, February of 2000. Old traditional companies were, you know, considered passe, and you know they were going to get put out of business by somebody in their garage with a dot-com idea. It's kind of funny when you think back to those days, but that's how we thought. And so that was an exciting idea to have that community do a charity event to celebrate what we could do for the nonprofit community, and at the same time we would have this business model where we would have volunteers help nonprofits with technology. And it came also, I had some personal experience, ironically, working with Hands on Atlanta, which Michelle Nunn started with a large group of my friends, as well as Steve had worked with Boys and Girls Club and helping him get a huge grant from Microsoft. And neither of these organizations at the time had a technology plan. And one was one of the most successful national organizations, one was one of the most successful local organizations. And so we learned from that there was a huge need to help nonprofits to create a technology plan. And it's not something that can easily be funded. So we figured we would take the money from the Digital Ball and use it to pay for technology plans, which would generate all these great ideas that nonprofits couldn't help but want to fund to create technology to change their organization. So that was the basic concept.
Yeah, so I think for those that know the Digital Ball, it's a very successful event. I think, you know, the question that a lot of people have, particularly nonprofit executives, is how did you start that event in a way that it could be so successful? Because a lot of nonprofits think about a signature event. It's very labor intense to bring it to bear, and then it doesn't always provide the revenue that, or the profit, or however you want to call that, to the organization. So what was it about the Digital Ball and the way that you designed it that it has continued to be a significant revenue generator for TechBridge?
So there were several things that came together to make the Digital Ball so successful right off the bat. I mean, the rule of thumb is that you're going to lose money the first year or two, maybe 3 years of a signature event like that, and that a startup should never think about doing a signature event. So we went to a large traditional nonprofit in the technology community and said, we've got this idea, and they basically told, this was before I was involved, they told the team, you're crazy, it's never going to be successful, we don't want to be associated with it. So on several levels, it was kind of crazy to do it. But the reason why it was successful, one reason was we had a good vision, and we went out and sold the vision, and we asked for a lot of money for that right out of off the bat. And we had a partner, Accenture, who when we pitched it to them, they got it right away. And they identified with it, and they saw how well it was consistent with their vision and their mission. And so that made a huge difference, because they came in as our first sponsor. They committed to $25,000 right off the bat. And that kind of set a high bar for everybody else. Mm. So that was one thing. The other thing was Silicon Valley Bank got behind it, and they had their whole sales team meeting with all their clients, you know, telling them about it. And so that's the other thing, is that you have to have a team of people that know how to ask for money and are willing to ask for money. But that first Digital Ball, we were selling Blue Sky and Vision, because we were struggling to have one client story we could tell at the Digital Ball of something we had done, because we had no clients. All we had was an idea. And then the other thing that was funny was we were told, you're not going to make any money, you'll be lucky to break even. So we ended up, we got $500,000 gross, and we netted $200,000. Wow. And which is unheard of for a first year charity event. And it's a testament to the support of the technology community, all the folks. Chris Klaus was our first honorary chair. Sig Mosley was very involved. So, and there was a whole raft of women that were actually involved. The Women in Technology group got behind it and really helped us get out to the community. Mike Adkinson from TechLink. So there were a lot of folks that really got behind it. But in spite of all that, I decided, well, let's go out there and talk about what our net was on the event. And instead of saying, wow, that's amazing, you generated $200,000 in profit, you should just be breaking even or losing money, then the conversation turned to, well, that's only a 40% net profit. You wasted $300,000 of donors' money throwing this big party, and what did that do for the community?
Wow.
So that was a learning experience in and of itself. And that's part of the reason why we created an award at the event, so that it never was about just the technology community just having a party for ourselves. It was about focusing the technology community and the needs of the broader community. So we created the Technology Innovation Award, which recognized at first things that the nonprofits were already doing. Now it's to come up with an idea for something new and innovative. But that, we did the videos about nonprofits and how they were using technology, and we took the focus off the technology community and put it on how technology could be used in the community. And obviously, as we've grown, the percentage of as you get more revenues,
right,
the percent, you know, you start throwing off more and more of the money to charity. So that went away. But it was interesting how people think about their donations. And how they expect there to be no overhead to throw an event like that. And that's a mistake I do see a lot of nonprofits making, is they fall into that trap. They try to create a very inexpensive event that, you know, the food gets rubbery, the entertainment gets boring, you know, the people who have to bring their spouses have to drag them there. So I do think it's important to try to create an event that people actually want to come to and have a good time, but it, at the same time, when they go home, they feel like it had a purpose, and that's a very difficult balance to strike, I think.
Did you have any key learnings about yourself as a leader when you think about, you know, you were second, third? I'm having a hard time keeping up with sort of the evolution of the different things that you've done, but at TechBridge, did you have any insights or any ahas as a leader, given that it was a nonprofit, and some of the things that you were able to do in the beginning with TechBridge?
So I guess the biggest difference between that and the startup I did that was venture-backed is that it's easy to use stock options and we're all going to get rich as a crutch to motivate people. And then TechBridge, we're not going to get rich. And there were still people, I mean, we were there after the crash, but we started during the boom. The boom was still going. And so to try to get anybody to line up behind TechBridge to work there and to work hard, it was all about the vision and what we were trying to accomplish. And so non-economic motivation and really creating a clear vision of why we're there, I think was helpful, you know, which is helpful in any venture, right? So even if you go back to the for-profit, if you can add that to the economic motivation, the why we're here, and I love, there's a TED Talk on focusing on the why. Simon Sinek, I think, is the guy's name, which is a great concept of focus on the why of your organization. And I think running a nonprofit really forces you, even nonprofits, though, they focus on the what and the how still, and they don't focus enough on the why. So I do think it gives you a chance to sharpen that aspect of leadership.
So before we transition, talk about your current entrepreneurial adventure, and then we'll also talk about some things that you're doing with recurring revenue at Points of Light. Sort of through this transition, how did you as a leader stay focused on, I guess, the goal that you had for yourself personally, whatever that was, as you've gone through different companies and iterations, you know, how do you stay focused on sort of whatever your bigger end game or vision is for you and your family?
That's the toughest question of all. So I would say, since you said family, I'll start there, because I didn't have a family going through all of those organizations that we just talked about, but I actually met my wife the first day we talked about TechBridge. Jennifer was the one that actually wrote the first business plan. So that was a case where I got to accomplish two goals at once by meeting my wife and starting an organization. But that doesn't happen every day. But I only met her because I wanted to do that, you know, community-oriented project. So I would say at this point in my life, I'm 53 now, I had started a family late in life. I got married at 42 and had kids at 44 and 46. So for me, my family is by far my most important thing. I'm still excited about, you know, growing companies and doing good in the world, but you know, my family comes first at this point. And when I was doing BSD and BT Squared, Twitter.com, you know, I was very focused on my business and just pretty much just my business.
And now there's children and a wife, and you kind of have to balance that. So how, before we talk about Zoos Mobile, did it change the way you looked at opportunities? You know, because you have to, I'm sure, continue to generate your own reoccurring revenue as you're investing in these new businesses. How does it change what you wanted to do or what you focused on?
Well, yes, I definitely think when you have kids, trying to be an entrepreneur at a raw startup, when you have kids, even if you're doing it with a significant amount of money in the bank, and especially if you're not, it's just difficult to work those kind of hours and be away from your family. That's an important change in my life, for sure. And it helped to have them later in life, I guess, because I was able to do that. Point of Light is a great opportunity to do, you know, I'm still in the technology space. I'm still growing a software business. It's a business that's very helpful for the world. We're encouraging people to volunteer and get involved in their community, so it's very satisfying. But it's also something I can balance my personal life and my work life.
Yeah, so let's go to Points of Light, and then we'll circle back to Zoos Mobile, since you were talking about sort of what they're doing. Talk to us a little bit about what you've been able to do at Points of Light. And one of the things in our conversation beforehand, you were talking about this idea of reoccurring revenue, and whether you're a for-profit or non-profit, figuring out a way to bring that into your financial model is, you know, helps you have that cash is king and being able to do the things that you want to do. So talk to us a little bit about what you are doing with Points of Light, because you're experiencing a lot of growth right now.
We are. It's actually pretty exciting. So we had a lot of it was set up for me. So I'd like to take credit for a lot of it, but some of it had already been in motion when I got there. So they had Points of Light as a result of a merger of Points of Light in Washington, D.C. with Hands-On Network in Atlanta, both of which were fairly large growing organizations. They decided they were in the same space and they would merge, and Michelle became CEO of the combined organization about 4.5 years
ago.
Michelle Nunn, sorry. Okay. Who's now running for U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the result of the merger of those two organizations, and the headquarters moved to Atlanta. And they each had a technology platform to support their network of nonprofit affiliate organizations around the country. And so when they merged the two technology platforms and decided to go with a Salesforce.com-based platform called Hands-On Connect. So that was originally developed for our 250 affiliates around the world. And the plan was to sell it outside the network, but it hadn't, that part hadn't been executed before I got there. So it's, you know, it's a very similar to any kind, any other kind of software company, except that we're selling to nonprofits. So we have to come at a price point that's acceptable, and it's a software as a service model, so that, you know, our clients pay us annually to keep essentially renting the software. So that's a helps an organization publish and publicize their volunteer opportunities, and it helps them manage them when they show up for the event, track their hours, and do all the reporting that they need to do. Then, right before I got there, they acquired the assets of All for Good, which was originally built by Google for the incoming Obama White House to promote volunteer. It was designed to be the Craigslist, and Craig Newmark was actually one of the original partners, as well as to be the Google of volunteer opportunities. And Google employees built the software on their in their 20% projects. So it had some great heritage, and it actually supports serve.gov, which is the White House's volunteering and consumer community engagement website. So if you go to whitehouse.gov and you say, I want to serve, it'll actually take you to the offergood.org site. They didn't have a business model, so they didn't have a recurring revenue model. It was all based on donations. The founder of that actually ended up, he's at the White House now, so he was looking for somebody to take over and run this organization and grow it. So we took it over about 2.5 years ago, and it's grown about 10x since we took it over in terms of number of searches. It's gone from about 5 million a year to we had 50 million searches on our engine over the last 12 months, and it's growing, you know, pretty much month over month. So that's very exciting.
How is, as a CTO there, how is that sort of managing that growth? What are the things you're having to maybe do differently from when you first got there to help address, which is, all things of growth are sort of good problems, quote unquote, to have. So what have you had to address in terms of challenges to meet that demand?
So I'd say it's technology, process, and people. Those are the three legs of the stool, I think, in any technology business. So we had to fix the technology and merge the two platforms together. So I had to fire the partner that was our developer. That's actually the first lawsuit I've ever been involved in at a nonprofit, go figure. But they were in it. That developer was in it for the wrong reasons. They were in it because they were in the financial space and they needed something to fill their book of business while the economy was turned down. So we had to fix that, make the software work better, make it work together. I made a couple of great hires. There's a woman that's working for me, Allison Lebreton, who had sold her own business as well, technology business, and is great at business development, client relationships, and project management. And she's done a fantastic job of building our revenue stream. And then process, which was with her help, is to, you know, have a very dependable process of releasing new products and how we go about the sales process, marketing to sales and closing deals. So just, you know, your classic blocking and tackling of process. But those are the three things.
I'm curious, how do you keep the mission-driven part of things? I mean, because the way you've explained it, it is very, having worked in technology companies and been around building software and installation and all of that, you know, you're just kind of focused on that implementation and those kinds of things. How do you stay connected to the mission of what the organization is, or is that even difficult?
Trying to make money versus focus on the mission. I think it helps that we're doing something that the more we do of it and the better we do it, it's automatically serving the mission. If we were trying to have cookie bake sales or something and using that to try to generate revenue, that would be a little bit of a distraction. But I actually think that helping other organizations manage their volunteers and recruit more volunteers is so central to our mission that it's actually very easy in our case. And we're actually making the transition from being strictly, you know, working with corporations and working with nonprofits to actually reaching out directly to people. We call it our direct to people initiative. So, you know, the only way you can really get direct to people at scale is with technology. Mm-hmm. So, I guess we're very fortunate in that the two can be so, you know, congruent.
Yeah, a lot of mission alignment is what I'm hearing.
That's a good way of putting it.
In a little bit of time that we have left, talk to us a little bit about your company, Zoos Mobile. I think that's the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that. And it has a different sort of financial model and how you've been able to grow that, as I understand it.
So Zoos Mobile was started in 2008 by Dr. Gil Weinberg, who's a professor. He ran the he's on leave right now, but he ran the Center for Music Technology at Georgia Tech, and he's created everything from musical robots to musical toys, and he came up with this app for the iPhone, where the iPhone was brand new, that you could make music with an iPhone. You could shake your phone, and depending on how you shook it, you could play different instruments. So you could play the drums, and if you're aiming at a cymbal, it would make a cymbal sound. If you were aiming like at a snare drum, it would make a snare drum sound. So it was fairly unique, and it actually rose to number 7 on the App Store back in the old days when there were only 150,000 apps on the App Store, if you can even remember that far back in 2008. And so he was looking to try to take that, you know, and build a business out of it. And so, you know, we've tried various things and we've had some success. I mean, we got back to number 32 on the paid App Store when there were 500,000 apps on the App Store. I think they just hit 1 million.
Wow.
There were literally hundreds of knockoffs of Chinese versions of our app.
Hmm.
So that's one thing I learned is when you're successful, there's like these people in China and elsewhere that just take the top 50 apps and they immediately try to knock it off and steal some of your market share. So that's a very interesting market, but that app was actually featured on CNN.com the day of Balloon Boy, if you remember that. And we had 250,000 downloads that day alone.
Wow.
But then I saw the economics. So I saw how little money we were going to make even with that degree of success. And so to our earlier conversation about recurring revenue model, there are some people that are being successful, but it's very, very difficult to have a standalone business selling apps on the App Store.
Hmm. So how have you then addressed your capital and your cash needs if it's not mostly through just the sale of this app?
Good question. So that... there's actually that company and one other company we haven't mentioned called Invistix that derived a lot of their financing from government grants. Invistix got venture capital and government grants. Zoos Mobile has been mostly funded from Georgia Research Alliance, which is a Georgia Tech-related investment group. It's received funds from the federal government through National Science Foundation and SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Grants. And we're eligible for the new Georgia Film and Game Tax Credit, which we're hoping to get in early 2014. Which encourages the development of gaming and film companies. So we switched from an app to a game because we learned that the only recurring revenue in mobile is with games, really.
Hmm.
Even the most successful music app company, Smule, I've seen their financials, and it's just, you know, it's very difficult, as I said, to make money. So we switched to a game. We hired Thrust Interactive, which is a game studio that helped us. They're a firm that helps design and build great games. So we brought in some outside expertise on the gaming side. We bring the music expertise. And through the, you know, all these government grants, we've developed a new app called Attunes that we're going to be releasing in the first half of 2014. So I'm just chairman of that company now. I'm not active on a day-to-day basis because I'm doing Points of Light. But it's a fun hobby at least, and I hope it will be a successful business.
So as I've listened to you talk in your various adventures, obviously technology is a core piece of that. How did you or did you see maybe early in your career that you might be able to take something that's core and then do a lot of different things? You talked about gaming and apps. We've talked about Points of Light and Volunteer. We've talked about TechBridge. We've talked about configuration products. So clearly technology is a core. But for our listeners who are trying to figure out how do I position myself so that I can take advantage of different opportunities, what would you say sort of helped you being able to do a number of different things in a number of different areas that people might not feel are really related?
Well, they're all things that I was passionate about for one reason or another. I've loved manufacturing, so I've done a bunch of companies around in and around manufacturing. I love music. I've been a musician my whole life, and I've been involved in the community and doing different, you know, community-related projects. So I would say those things, and then I just love technology and software, and I always have. So the first thing I would say is you got to do something you love. I mean, I do remember in 1998, my CTO went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "I'm learning Java." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Because I think I can make more money programming than being a doctor."
Wow.
I mean, and then I would go to business schools recruiting, and, you know, no one wanted to work for Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. They all wanted to work for a startup. And 3 years later, they don't want to work for a startup. So, I mean, I think if that's the degree of commitment that you have, you're not going to be in it for very long. But if you do something that you're already passionate about, there's plenty of times when you ask yourself, why am I doing this? And if you don't enjoy it, you're going to have a hard time getting through those times to get to the good times, because a lot of it is just being around long enough. I mean, Zoos Mobile survived, you know, for a long time. I think we'll end up being successful just because we found ways to survive and keep at it.
Yeah. The other thing is I've been listening to you that strikes me is you've done a number of different things, obviously because you're passionate about it. But there must also be something that you see an opportunity and you're willing to go toward it. And I think for our listeners, and as someone who is an entrepreneur who stepped out there, is, you know, how do you sort of make decisions about those opportunities? I'm sure there were other things that you could have gotten involved in that had that mix of what you're passionate about in technology. But kind of how do you make the decision about what the next opportunity is you're going to invest yourself in?
So, I mean, I've made some mistakes, too. So I would say the other aspect of it is to enjoy the people you're working with and respect the people you're working with. So I can always say that I've worked with very smart people who really worked hard and cared about the mission. So there was always a strong sense of, you know, teamwork and commitment to a goal. And that helps a lot, too. But I haven't always worked with people I've enjoyed in every single venture. I doubt anybody could say that about every single thing they've done.
And I won't put you on the spot.
And I'm not going to. But I would say that that's one thing I've learned is that, you know, if you're passionate about what you do and you like the people you're working with and you see that there is a potential for financial, you know, reward or for some kind of other reward. I mean, I think the reward I get from TechBridge of seeing an organization that's going strong after 13 years and all the good that we're doing in many ways is more rewarding than financial success, because it's more of a legacy, and that's really a rare thing to feel. So, you know, if you have that three things, the passion, the people, and then either the legacy or the financial success or opportunity for those things, then that's enough to get you through those tough days.
Well, Scott, you've been a great guest this morning. I'm going to sort of my last question. Well, actually, before I even do that, for people that are interested in Points of Light and Zeus Mobile, how would they learn more about either of those?
So Zeus Mobile has a few apps on the App Store. If you haven't, it's on iPhone and iPad only. So you could check out some of our apps, Zooz. Points of Light, you can go to pointsoflight.org, or our products are allforgood.org, which we just relaunched, and handsonconnect.org are the two sites we have for our two products.
Great. So the question that I ask all my guests is, think back to your 20-year-old self, if you could put yourself back there. And given what you have experienced and what you know today, if you were going to tell our listeners, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self, knowing what you know today? What would you say?
Well, I think when I was 20, my grandfather, who started our car business selling Model A's door-to-door, I remember him saying, you know, if I were your age, I would be in computer software. And I was headed for a accounting degree at the time, and I just remember thinking, man, that's a much more exciting field and something I would really be excited about. And I really switched. I switched in my undergraduate that year to take computer classes, and found a master's degree program that I could go to without a undergraduate degree. And so I would say, if you're 20, make sure you're on a trajectory to doing something that you're excited about and something that you think for the next 40 years is something that's going to propel you into some interesting opportunities.
Oh, great. Well, we wish you much success in 2014, Scott. Thanks for being our first guest of 2014. And for our listeners, join us again here, 10 o'clock on Fridays. So let's talk about it, because
growth matters.